Welcome to Mill City Hall. This is a Minneapolis politics podcast. You can find us on millcityhall.com, where we've got episode notes and references for every episode. You can also find us on Instagram. Mill City Hall is the handle. We try to share punchy little clips on there that you can share and spread around. And today we are going to try to tell the story of Jacob Fry. How did we go from a pledge to end homelessness to an intractable Groundhog's Day of camp clearing? How do we go from a pledge of I'll make it a mission of collaborating with the city council every day to a systemic trench warfare between the mayor's camp and the council majority? And how do we go from crowds chanting shame at the mayor to the mayor winning more executive power than any mayor in generations? I am Jesse Mortensen. We're recording in my living room in Corcoran, South Minneapolis for perhaps the last time. I am moving like 7 blocks south, so future recordings will be from another location. And I have lived in Minneapolis for about a decade, done campaign work mostly as a volunteer, doing grassroots stuff, door knocking, etc., for quite a long time in both of our twin cities. And I'm joined by my co-host.
My name is Cam Gordon. I live in the Seward neighborhood, and I'm going to be, I guess, willing to take the 7 blocks to get a little further in order to keep doing the podcast. Delighted to be here. I served on the city council for 16 years, and I'm here with Robin Garwood.
Yeah, I'm Robin Garwood. I worked for Cam for 16 years in City Hall. I now live in St. Paul.
So before we dig into the whole narrative, or at least our attempt at a narrative, in case anybody doesn't stay to the end, let's just be really clear. We are all at a conclusion that we do not want to see Jacob Fry reelected. So let's just do a spoiler here for the conclusion in case you don't stick around for all the details. If there's anybody out there who is not totally decided, let me urge you to not rank Jacob Fry. I think we have 3 really good candidates who are worth ranking above Jacob Fry. And for me, the short version of Jacob Fry as mayor is that he's just bad at doing some very basic governance stuff. And I feel he's been massively subsidized by certain crises that have put him in a position where he doesn't have to prove that he's good at anything. He's not good at doing the things he says he'll do. He routinely misleads and obscures. He's not good at being an executive. And I think he's a conservative force in the city because he doesn't have to demonstrate delivery on progressive outcomes. Now, he does have to block certain progressive outcomes to keep his coalition together, but he doesn't have to, and they'll be fine with some of those. You know, if there are some progressive outcomes that slip through this, you know, his coalition's not going to throw him out for that, but there are certain ones he absolutely has to block, and he does not absolutely have to tangibly deliver very much of a progressive agenda to keep his coalition together. So that is me, you know, just want to skip to the end a little bit and be honest about where my bias and lens comes in as we go in and talk about this. Anybody else want to do a skip right to the spoiler?
Sure. I've never voted for Jacob Fry, and I publicly endorsed his opponents in the past, and I won't be endorsing him now. I think he's got his supporters, and he's kind of picked out where he'll fight and what he'll do and what he'll push and fight against, and it's contrary to the things that I believe are best for the city of Minneapolis.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I guess I would just add a couple of things. It just in terms of his character, because I've now known Jacob pretty up close and personal when we served for 4 years with him as a fellow city council member and then for 4 years as mayor, and I've learned some of the things that I think make him tick and some of his just like personality traits. One of them is that he is. He is definitely not a truthful person, but in a very particular kind of a lawyerly way. He focuses in on technicalities to try to advance a case that is fundamentally not true a lot of the time, which I think is bad just personally, but I think it's also really bad for an elected official and especially an executive. as we're seeing now with the Trump administration too, I think somebody who routinely doesn't describe things accurately and lies to people, that's someone who shouldn't be in power. The other one is that there's a strange thing where I think Jacob Frey really wanted everyone to love him. The public of Minneapolis, his fellow elected officials, and he's gotten himself into a strange and almost like tragic or tragicomic place with the people and with a lot of his fellow elected officials, where he really doesn't get along with very many people anymore. There's a small coterie of folks who are on his side that he gets along with, and everyone else, as far as I can tell, he has stopped trying to win their votes, win their support on the council, and is just in kind of a bunker at this point. So I think we could talk more about like how that happened, because I do think there was a long arc that got us to this point. But yeah, he's a bad mayor. It's interesting that we have a new strong mayor system while we have a very weak person being the mayor. And yeah, he's bad for the city and he's got to go.
Bad mayor, sad mayor. Well, let's turn back the clock and let's go through the story. So Jacob Frey comes on the scene as a political candidate quite a while ago now. Robert, you want to kick us off?
Well, and even before that, he got involved as a fundraiser against the marriage amendment. The big thing that he did was this thing called the Big Gay Race, and running was definitely a big part of his brand. Maybe has always been a big part of his brand. It seems like it's...
And not running for offices.
No, running, like literally
running.
Long distance running. And he had had some sort of... I never really got the details about how successful his career was, but he's a runner, and I think was even like a competitive runner. And so, you know, when he wanted to raise money against the horrible, horrible marriage amendment that the Republicans had put forward, he organized a race to raise money. And then he parlayed that into running for an open seat in the state Senate in a special election that was won by Carrie Dietzick. And so the first time I really noticed him was when he competed for the Take Action endorsement that Mahmoud Noor received. And he seemed very young. He seemed very energetic. He was really like the old thing where Wellstone would like roll his sleeves up. It was that kind of energy, and it was like real barnstorming kind of stuff.
Did it resemble R.T. Ryback? I was never around R.T. that much, but from a distance, I've always thought, oh, he's kind of grabbing a little of that persona.
Not really, as far as my feelings about it. R.T. always came off as being a little bit more, I don't know what else to say, but serious. Jacob seemed like a very enthusiastic puppy, like a golden retriever puppy or something that was really, you know, it was like very full of energy and life, and would do kind of whatever you wanted him to do to please you. And so he was really trying to sell this room of progressive folks who were definitely not going to endorse him on him being, you know, a good person, a strong candidate, and super enthusiastic. And I remember, you know, Take Action does this thing with like pluses and deltas, like what do you like and what would you change about this candidate? After the candidate leaves, there's like a discussion time. And there were surprisingly a lot of pluses in that room, where it was all about like energy, drive. He seems like he should really run for something, but I think we should go with Mahmoud for this race this year. Not a lot negative was said about him, as I recall, in that room. And then he parlayed that. So that was 2011. He came in, I think, fourth. It was like Carrie Dietzick, Mahmoud Noor, Peter Wagenius, and then Jacob Frey with just a handful.
In the primary election.
Yeah, in the special election primary. So yeah. Very low turnout. He didn't have much of a base. It seemed like he was kind of using it as like a first step to get his name out there. And then the big turning point was he ran against Diane Hofstede for Ward 3 in 2013. And Diane Hofstede was just a terrible, terrible council member. And not in terms of being ideologically terrible, though I think she basically was. She was very aligned with Barb Johnson and kind of part of, I mean, Al Hofstede was her, father-in-law?
Yeah.
And so she's part of like one of the old Minneapolis political dynasties. So she was very much like wedded to Barb, especially after a while on the council. But she was famous for like, she brought three or four reams of undifferentiated paper with her everywhere she went and would like stack it on the council dais and never look at it. It was almost like a prop kind of. And she also went through 37 staff in the time that
seems too high. It can't possibly be that high.
I think that might be low. I literally think she was like brutalizing her staff. Her staff had to ask permission to use the restroom and stuff like that.
And we didn't want to beat up on her too much, but just what ended up happening is her staff got hired and supervised by the city clerk's office, and she no longer actually managed her own staff near the end because it got so bad.
Jeez. There had to be an intervention to deal with the whole thing. And some of the folks who ended up being big Jacob Frey supporters, both in that election in 2013 and then for years afterwards. So like Peter Ebnett is a good example of this. He came to the city working for Diane Hofstede, and part of, I think, what he really liked about Jacob Frey is that Jacob Frey got rid of her. It took her out in the 2013 election because he had seen just how dysfunctional the inside of that office was. And the other thing to know about that 2013 election is that basically everybody other than Barb Johnson was supporting Jacob Frey. A lot of folks on the council who weighed in on that race were supporting the challenger. He had Lisa Goodman, but he also had Elizabeth Glidden, I think. I mean, I think he had folks from both sides of the council at that time thinking that he was, you know, the same kind of stuff, like energetic, bright, real go-getter with some drive. He convinced enough progressives that he was a progressive candidate and that Diane was sort of a conservative, which was basically true. That he seemed like the progressive choice, but then he also made a lot of friends with the big money in Minneapolis politics, specifically Lisa Goodman and the people that she could introduce him to.
So 2013, he gets elected to the city council.
With a pretty overwhelming vote. You know, really, really beat.
Yeah, y'all are on the council yourselves for how long at that point?
That must have been our second term starting?
No, our third.
Third. Okay. So 8 years.
So we had been on the council for 8 years at that point, and then...
Yeah, so this new energetic voice shows up. First impressions, what was it like initially having him as a peer?
Well, one of the things that was clear from the beginning, I guess, was that he was going to be more aligned with the long-term entrenched DFLers on the council. I had trouble connecting with him. It seemed like he didn't really necessarily want to meet and talk to me. So I felt like he had some difficulty dealing with me, maybe because of my age or that I wasn't in the majority party. Although he did build better relationship with Robin at the beginning, I think. And it was a relief that Diane wasn't there. But let's figure this guy out and what's going to happen. And one of the first big votes made it really clear that he was going to be on the other side, if you could count it as a divide, because a lot of times the biggest early decision is council president. And sometimes the council is divided on it. And there was definitely a group of us that wanted a new president. Barb Johnson had been president, and she wanted to continue to be president. And I think it was a 7-6 vote. And Barb became president, and Jacob supported her.
And that that outcome was strange to me, because the 2013 election had been kind of a progressive wave election. It was the same one that ushered in Lisa Bender in Ward 10, beating Meg Tuthill, who was a more conservative incumbent. I believe that's the election that Andrew Johnson beat Sandy Colvin-Roy. So a lot of the folks who had been the most associated with Barb and her way of doing things and the more conservative lean on the council had been beaten. And or had, you know, Don Samuels had run for something. I think he had run for mayor and lost and was replaced by Blong, right? That was when Blong won.
Yeah.
So there was this sense that things have, you know, it was a change election. We had we now have this great opportunity. We had a new mayor in Betsy Hodges, and now we have this opportunity to have the council be run by somebody who is maybe more aligned with the middle of the council, because Barb was by far the most conservative person on the council, like way over on the right side of everything. If you go back to divided votes, she was willing to eat a 12-1 vote if she thought that it was a bad idea. So like ranked choice voting, there were folks who didn't like the idea, but went ahead and voted for it anyway once it was clear that we had the petition signatures to get it on the ballot. But Barb, you know, stuck in and said, I don't like that. I don't want to do that. It's bad. This change is bad. And so the idea that this new council with all of these new fresh faces, which was like, I think the median age dropped by 20 years or something, that they would reelect Barb Johnson was very odd.
And I believe the other person who was getting support was Elizabeth Glidden. And that also indicated to me that clearly an alignment with Goodman probably helped him get elected. And Goodman definitely worked with Barb and liked the committee structure that Barb was going to be proposing and all that support. So it definitely sent a message.
Yeah, I think that was the key thing. I think Jacob felt that Lisa Goodman had brought him to the dance, and he had to continue to dance with her. And the people that she grants access to, like the Kaplans, the real money of Minneapolis politics, was not necessarily quite in his pocket or whatever, in his corner, the way that they are now. He had to have an entree to that, and that person was Lisa Goodman. And so on this big first vote that would define the way that the council operated, he wasn't like Blong or Lisa Goodman or others in Barb's coalition who were just there with her from the very start. He did this whole Hamlet act where he was like hemming and hawing, and he was the guy in the very center, in the middle. He was the tipping point vote, and he knew he was the tipping point vote, and he kind of really liked that. But he kind of really hated it, because he wanted to take a vote that everybody would be okay with, and it became increasingly clear that that was not possible, that he was the guy who was going to decide between Elizabeth Glidden and Barb Johnson as council president, and whatever he did, he was going to piss some people off, and he was going to set himself on a certain trajectory, and he kind of tried to deny that, I think, even to himself, that that was happening, and sort of elided that divide. You know, I don't have to be on a side. I don't have to pick a side. But he did pick a side, and it was the side of the sort of big money and conservative forces of Minneapolis politics. And then he never left it. He's been on that side ever since.
And Barb Johnson, not a consensus maker, as I understand her role in politics. So this was not like, you know, I'm choosing someone who's more moderate in any way, shape, or form, either temperamentally or on policy. This is like, yeah, we're going with somebody here who is going to keep an old style of politics that she had pretty tight control over.
Yeah, I would say loose control. It's interesting because she knew that the council didn't agree with her, and she knew that the council was going to do much more progressive stuff than she would personally like. So she kind of kept her powder dry until it really mattered. And then she would use bare knuckle tactics. I mean, a lot of why several of the people who were aligned with Barb lost their reelection bids was that she used strong arm tactics to push through the Viking Stadium deal on a 7-6 vote, weirdly with Lisa Goodman against her on that. So you know, it's not 100% aligned all the time, but you know, that's what cost, I think, Sandy Colvin-Roy her job, among other things. But it was one of the big issues that folks were running against incumbents on. You know, you supported this terrible stadium deal. And so that was the kind of thing. It was like Barb would let a lot of stuff slide until she decided that something mattered and that she could stop it, or she could, in very rare cases like the Viking Stadium, push a bad thing through. Usually it was about stopping us from doing.
And Barb wasn't the only one on the Viking Stadium either. And she also, I think, had an interesting leadership style, because I think she did want to see council members succeed, and she knew young people were getting elected, and she knew a lot about City Hall and those kinds of things, and she wasn't going to just go against everything that you wanted to do. And even when you wanted to do stuff and she was going to vote against it in the end, she would give you advice about how to do it and where to take it next and what should happen there and all of those kinds of things. So she was an interesting kind of low-key leader in that way, behind the scenes. I'm not saying she necessarily did that stuff on the dais and when she was out there working it, but and I was even, we even worked on one thing together, Barb and I, because that was one of my goals when I got elected, is to try to co-author something with everybody. And she was willing to do it when we were tightening up renter controls kind of over landlords and that. She supported that whole idea, although she didn't actually do much work on the project. I basically did most of the work, but she co-authored it. So,
and having her as a co-author made it really easy to get it passed.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, she had a, I heard from various council members who were of the younger generation who felt like going to Barb's office was like being called to the principal's office. There was that feeling.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, this isn't about Barb either.
That's true. That's true. You know, it's interesting, Rob, you tell that, make that Hamlet metaphor. My experience, my primary experience with Jacob Fry as a council member was vis-a-vis the $15 minimum wage campaign. And I was a very active volunteer with that campaign, ended up being the treasurer for the like 15 Now action, whatever we called it. That was the kind of like PAC, you know, the political action arm of that versus the like nonprofit, strictly, you know, strictly educational arm of it. And I was relatively new to Minneapolis politics at the time, so I didn't have, you know, strong priors about everybody coming into it. But it was really clear from kind of being in and around some of the kind of mid, early to mid part of the campaign meetings where the campaign was starting to lobby city council members and try to set up who might, you know, help get this thing passed, that we had a meeting with Jacob Fry where he was very like, hey, I'm so excited about this. I'm 100% on your side. Can't we, you know, I'm like really trying to be your ally here. And then from later developments and public statements and actions, that it became clear that he was equally courting the other side of the issue. So as somebody who really wanted to see the minimum wage raised in the city, and was putting a lot of time and effort, you know, collecting signatures. We collected thousands of signatures eventually. Jacob Fry, I was really galled by the way he behaved around that thing. Like, it was, to me, really upsetting to see some, you know, see in action somebody be sort of that two-faced, you know, to like tell us one thing and then tell the people who are, you know, literally our strongest opponents in the city a different thing, and then to try to like it really did seem like he was in my word was always like triangulate, you know, like Bill Clinton style, like find some precise, you know, teeny little intersection where both sides don't hate you too bad and begrudgingly, you know, like have to support you or something. But it was really, yeah, it was really, really pissed me off. I mean, I was really angry at Jacob Fry as a council member in the way that he treated us so dishonestly as a, just around an issue that like should be a very like bread and butter issue that, you know, like there's no, how dare you be this dishonest about, we're talking about like raising working people's wages, you know, like some of the most vulnerable people in the city and like making their lives better. It really, really, really angered me even back then.
he really, I think, had trouble with that whole issue. And I think maybe he didn't really know what was important or priority, but it also was a very complicated issue. And finding a win-win was difficult. I actually think the city made a very complicated array of decisions around that, and it worked out really, really well because they were willing to, you know, phase it in. There were big companies, small companies, and we tied a cost of living with it indefinitely. So I think it was ended up being a really good law. I think Jacob was completely confused about it and didn't know what to do, partly because of what you guys are saying. He wanted to please everybody, and probably part of him wanted to deliver everything everybody wanted. And I remember him being so caught in the middle around the tip credit idea. I think he really wanted to help small businesses and restaurants, and he wanted to be supportive of what they were trying to do, and they were all pressuring to do certain things. But he also was probably wanted to look good with the workers. And he was still trying to make amendments and chip away at it when I think we already had a pretty good compromise built that was going to be successful and without giving a tip credit. So,
and it has been successful, right? Like the apocalypse, the restaurant apocalypse did not happen. Obviously certain restaurants have failed and turned over, like, but it's a hard industry and that happens. We haven't seen any kind of, you know, it's been a long time since that policy passed. I think that compromise has held very well.
Yes, there were lots of doomsday scenarios that were coming up during the hearing and other places, and none of them seems to have panned out. People just now kind of take it as a normal course of action, and oh, maybe we should actually bump it up higher is what I hear more of than this has been a bad thing for business. So people have adjusted to it. I think it turned out to be a pretty good law, but Jacob, I think, was lost. Sometimes I don't think he really has a clear rudder or a compass for where he wants to go necessarily. You know, I did want to talk a little bit about the first budget that he had to vote on, too.
But before you get to that, there's something else that is really important to remember and to know about what motivated him to be, you know, in another one-act Hamlet play on the minimum wage. And it's not just that he, I mean, you had concerns and were willing to take seriously the concerns of restaurateurs who had restaurants in Ward 2, but you had the freedom to hear those concerns and hear the things that the workers were saying and the advocates were saying, and kind of make up your own mind based on your own values. And in a certain sense, Jacob had foreclosed that freedom for himself by taking a huge amount of money from the people who own not just restaurants, but like lots of restaurants. There are a couple of big restaurant like groups. I forget the names of them now, but the guy who owns like Blue Door, and there are folks who own several restaurants, and not in like a franchise kind of way. They're like, you know, cool local seeming restaurants. And he had taken a lot of money from those folks and their friends. They were a big chunk of where his money for the Ward 3 race in 2013 had come from. And so he felt like he had to get their backs, had to defend them from this thing. And I, you know, I have heard this now from enough people that I basically know that it's true, though I didn't see it happen myself. But I basically know that he went to the restaurants and said, I'm going to support the minimum wage, but don't worry, you're not going to have to pay it. I'm going to make sure that it doesn't apply to your servers.
The tip credit, which yes, basically discounts your wage by wages, by tips, I should say, right? It's like, you don't have to pay a minimum wage. The tips count for that, a substitute for that.
And there are various different ways to do it. I mean, there are some places where tipped workers just don't get a minimum wage, like, at all in the local ordinance. And there are places where your tips have to make up at least to the minimum wage. And if they don't, you know, it has to be backfilled by the employer. But that was the two-faced thing, the mendacity that you were talking about, Jesse, was he wanted to go to the advocates and say, I am I am on your side. Let's do this. And partly, I think what he wanted to do was flank Betsy Hodges on the left, because she was, for a long time, saying this would work better at a regional level. And then the advocates were saying, can we actually make that happen? And she was saying, I don't know, maybe you can. And they were saying, well, you're the mayor of Minneapolis. Let's do it here now. And it was hard to get her on side. And he jumped out along with Cam and Alondra Cano and a few others, saying we should absolutely do this here in a really full-throated way, like at the Union Hall up in Northeast. I remember he was at a meeting there and just said an unequivocal, yes, let's do this. And then simultaneously went to the restaurateurs and said, don't worry about it. I'm going to protect you from it. It's not going to have the effect on you. And I think that in that kind of lawyerly way, I think what he was thinking was like, all of this is technically true. I am telling the supporters that I support the minimum wage, and I do. It just, you know, I'm not going to say the part about not for everybody.
Right. It's not the support that we mean and we hear.
Right.
It's the support that he means.
Yes.
And doesn't want us to really hear.
Yes. And we were able to beat him and the sort of restaurant lobby on the tip penalty concept. He then did a whole host of different strange little amendments. I don't know if you remember this, but he had like, I don't know, 20. He had all kinds of amendments at the very last meeting where we were passing the minimum wage, and all of them were in a very narrow, technocratic way, trying to chip away at its impact mostly on restaurants. Mm-hmm. So it was like extending the phase in for small employers to a longer period of time and stuff like that. Recrafting what that bucket looked like so that it would include more employers, like, you know, employers with more employees than what the staff had recommended. And a lot of little stuff like that, some of which he won and some of which he lost, as I recall. But that, you know, it was a very good example of that era of his style of politics, trying and basically failing to be on everybody's side and having it show that, like, no, you're on the side of the wealthy and the powerful against the poor and the powerless and against progressive change. Not as, you know, not the way that Barb Johnson was, not just out of hand, but like, when the chips are down, you're basically on the side of the money. And all of your protestations to the contrary are a little bit thin.
He could at least tell the small restaurants that he tried because of all those amendments, I guess.
Yeah. So you wanted to talk about that latte levy.
Oh, yeah, I did want to talk about that. The end of the first year, the first budget that he had to vote on, is because I wasn't quite sure where he was at. I think it was pretty clear throughout the year that he was not necessarily as progressive as he made out to be. I mean, he was definitely very strong on same-sex marriage and those kinds of things, and so was everybody by that time, I guess, at least on the council. But there was a very strange amendment at the budget. This was Betsy Hodges' first budget, and she came in, and Betsy had some things she was really working on that I really supported. One of them was zero waste. Another one was pushing for some clean energy, and another big one was racial equity. And this is something I had worked on for years, was kind of raising this issue about racial disparities in the city, and it isn't fair. We should do something about it. And there was all this idea that we could create a new little department, racial equity department, to work on it and create a plan to how we could address the disparities. Betsy bought into that, put it in the budget. And
Betsy
then
campaigned on that. I mean, Betsy campaigned on One Minneapolis. And one of the things that I found really, really striking about her 2013 race is that she was talking about racial equity everywhere all the time. In a certain sense, she's kind of like the anti-Jacob Fry, because she would go to the downtown chamber and talk about racial equity. And they didn't want to hear about that, but she wanted them to hear about that, whether they liked it or not. And so, like, it was a big plank of what she wanted to accomplish as mayor.
And anyway, I think it's a big plank of what she wants to accomplish in her life. I think she's even carried that forward now. And it was clear that her whole, I mean, it was kind of amazing that somebody from Ward 13, the wealthiest ward.
And a very white ward also.
A very white ward, probably the whitest. And I don't think she talked about racial equity quite so much when she ran for council. So that was kind of like a sneak attack, because when she then wanted to leverage it to run for mayor, but she obviously had a lot of support in the ward because she was a council member, and so that was helpful. But her person who came next, Lene Pomisano, didn't have that necessarily, didn't care about that so much, and she proposed, let's cut some money. It was just to lower the levy, I think, and look really tough on taxes, you know.
So this was Pomisano's proposal, you're saying?
Pomisano's proposal, yep. And I think people calculated and said, oh, well, everybody's taxes, property taxes, will go down about $2.50. So that's how it got the name the Latte Levy. And it was an amendment just to lower it a small bit. But they had to cut money from some places, and they cut them from some really places that were really important to me and for a lot of people on the council and to the mayor. So it was also, I think, to make, I don't know, it was an attack on some of those initiatives. And the big thing was that Jacob went along with it. To me, that was another signal that said, oh, he's obviously going to be a problem. He's not going to want to be aligned with us very much at all. And he's going for all of this silliness anyway. And it was disappointing. That was a 7-6 vote. We ended up clawing back some of that. So we did create that racial equity division. We took money, I think, from the convention center or somewhere.
Because Kevin Reich flipped back on that vote.
All right.
Yeah. Betsy Hodges had an interesting take on that, which is that she came and she spoke on the budget and she like basically made direct eye contact, just stared Kevin down, because she knew that he was the like weakest link on the Barb and Lisa side on that vote. And she said, if there's one thing in my budget that you vote for today, I hope it will be the racial equity team. It just like staring at him. And that... Her impression, anyway, is that got his vote. Who knows what really happened?
Yeah. Well, it was an interesting, it was one of the bigger budget battles. I think I voted against that budget in the end because we didn't get everything back that I wanted, but we got some of it back, and it was worth that. But
it was so desperately silly. The whole thing was so silly. It was just about making a show of being a deficit hawk or whatever, about, you know, like taking a firm line on property taxes. It did nothing structurally to like reduce the actual growth of property taxes. The latte levy thing was a fun and funny way to talk about it. And it's great that it was branded as that. I think that idea came out of Alondra Cano's office. I'm not sure if it was Aisha Gomez or Ashley Fairbanks who came up with that, but like it was really good messaging about it. And for those of us, I mean, you and I had lived through the property tax crises after the Great Recession, mm-hmm. where the whole north side of the city had its value just like plummet. And that really hurt people in Southwest whose value declined a little bit, but didn't plummet, and we're now shouldering a much greater portion of that burden at the same time that there were LGA cuts, at the same time that, you know, we had to institute wage freezes, you know, it there had been hard budget times that the rest of us had lived through. And then Lene got into office during a pretty flush time when everything was basically fine and created a massive problem that Jacob sided with, basically just for show.
And maybe there was a campaign commitment. I'm going to lower property taxes. And she felt like she had to do something. It kind of felt like a rookie mistake. But look, she's still there and she's still very popular. So maybe it was a move that paid off. But it was also a move that told me that we're not going to be able to rely on Jacob for anything that we want to do in terms of supporting the values that I supported most. Even with climate, which he talks about a lot and was popular, but there was money in there that they took it away from the Clean Energy Partnership too. And it's like, so sort of like the crazy new wild green things that got in the budget is what Lene went after. And But and we also got our curbside composting back in too, so we made that little step as well.
So there's another thing that I recall from that first year, which was just sort of seeing him in public and hearing him in public and thinking, this guy is not ready for prime time. He's not fully baked yet or something. There's like he just says weird things. You remember he would say from the dais that we needed to have it be a city where people could stumble home at 3 a.m. from a bar. And he was his way of talking about like making the city walkable and bikeable. It's like that's just such a weird way to talk about that. Like public, like getting drunk to the point where you can't really walk anymore is a thing that we want to build the city around.
Going after the college vote. And kidding, college guys.
We had an unveiling, a groundbreaking for a bike trail that went under the I-35 bridge that you and Betsy Hodges and various other people had fought for the money for after the I-35 bridge collapse.
I call it the Peter Arginius Tunnel.
Yeah.
Memorial Tunnel.
So Jacob was invited because it was on the edge of Ward 3 of his ward, and he came to it in that first year. And he gave a little speech because you're an elected official, you get to make a little speech. You did, and Betsy did, and Peter McLaughlin did, and whatever. But then Jacob got to give his little speech, and he was trying to be humble, I think, and say, you all did the work for this, and I'm just going to get to reap the political benefit. But the way that he put it was in a running metaphor, like a lot of what he did in that first term, everything was always about running. He said, this is like a marathon where people from the past, you all have done, run the hard race, and you're about to hand the baton off to me, and you've been running, and you're exhausted, and you've got bloody nipples, and you're... And I remember being in that crowd and thinking, bloody what? Like, what did you just say? Is that a thing? Does that happen? Is that like a marathon thing? And I'm looking around at other people and thinking, did everybody else just hear that? What did he just say? And it was not an uncommon experience with him to hear weird shit that was just like, why are you saying that? That's not... There's no gravitas or whatever in these phrases.
Did you do more research and find out if that was a real thing?
I think I nudged someone who looked like a running kind of a person and said, is that a thing? And they said, yeah, that's totally a thing.
Yeah, it turns out really, that is really a real bad thing. And
great reason not to run. Yeah, I'm just saying.
Reason one of many why I'm not a runner.
It never happened to me, but the most I ever ran was like 10 miles, which was really hard for me.
Oh, Greg. Wow, but 10 miles.
Nipples were clean.
Most I've ever run was maybe 50 feet. I like bicycles.
Well, I think we should talk about how Jacob became mayor in the first place. And for me, again, as like at that point, I was sort of a relative newcomer to Minneapolis politics. And Black Lives Matter was a big deal. Folks were putting themselves out on the line, organizing, mobilizing a lot. Jamar Clark had been killed. I was spending a lot of time up at that occupation of the police precinct building up on the north side. And so a lot of my perception of that mayoral race was kind of through that lens of like, this awful kind of capricious killing of this man happened very quickly. This is, nationally, like we're up in arms about this because it's got to stop. This is, it's a huge pattern, not just locally, but nationally. And I was really mad at Betsy Hodges as mayor because I was, I'd heard the racial justice rhetoric, and then I was there, camping and standing in the street and watching the cops, just fire marking rounds at people around me. And it really felt like, okay, when the movement came to the door that the mayor of Minneapolis was not going to hold the police accountable. And so I was very ready for a new mayor, but was not a Jacob Price supporter. I had that experience with the $15 minimum wage campaign, and I was like, no, this guy sucks. Definitely not that guy. But that's kind of how that was my main lens on that election. How did you guys see what was happening in that election?
Well, there's an just about the Jamar Clark protests. Now, I went up there a lot, but a lot less than you did, and I think a lot less than Cam did. I think Cam, you were up there quite a bit. And there were other city council members who were up there quite a bit. Lisa Bender was up there a lot.
Yep.
Alon Ricano was up there a lot. Jacob Fry maybe stopped by.
I don't even
Yeah, I don't remember I seeing don't know that he hide ever nor hair.
So he was not there was a huge issue of citywide importance. And he stayed away, partly, I think, at the behest of the council member of the ward, Blong Yang, but also of Barb Johnson, who had kind of, I think they were really mad that council members from the south side were like messing around in this issue that they had. I think they had a conception of it as being kind of parochial. You know, it's like, this is a north side thing and you should let north siders deal with it. And we were like, no, this is a city thing and a race thing and a policing thing, and we're in charge of the police, and so we've got to get involved.
Well, the mayor is in charge of the police.
Yeah. Well,
sorry.
We fund them.
And we want to get control of them.
but Jacob was not one of the people who was out there on the streets trying to.
It seemed like
that situation.
Police killing was something he stayed away from. There was another police killing that he got very involved with, however, which ultimately I think he decided to run for mayor because it was a big opportunity to take on Hodges because she looked even worse.
Well, so the killing of Justine Damon Ruzczyk, I think, happened really late in that campaign. So he capitalized on it quite a bit. And it was really, really telling that he had been nowhere for Jamar Clark. He had been nowhere on the north side. And then he went straight down into Ward 13 when a white woman was killed by a black cop. And just to be perfectly clear, like, her killing was also a tragedy and it shouldn't have happened. And it's another example of horrible police violence, but it's not the kind of horrible police violence that usually happens. It's like a dog, man bites dog version of the story of police violence. But he stood there with Lene Palmisano and made it basically a campaign issue. And so I found that really notable, that like he ran on, we need a better police department. He ran on, this is the mayor's responsibility. You know, there's that famous clip that Wedge Live uses all the time, that this, you know, the police are the sole responsibility of the mayor, and really tried to say Betsy has not done that job well. And that resonated, I think, with a lot of folks who felt, you know, like that was true, because it was true. The police department has never functioned well in Minneapolis, and Betsy didn't change that. But I think he was able to tap into something different down in Ward 13, down in the wealthier, whiter part of the city, where they had just felt that kind of for the first time, that the police department was out of control. And he hadn't been there on the issue prior to that.
Yeah. And I just want to read that quote off, because I think it's really, there's like three quotes from his campaign materials in 2017 that to me really underscore how far away from what he promised that he would do and how he would act versus reality, and where we've come and how he's acted and what outcomes he's helped to usher in. And that one is definitely one of them, right? So in 2017, in a campaign video, he says,
"You know, I think it goes without saying, but you know, we've had a massive uptick in violent crime, specifically shootings, and some of the worst police community relations in a long time. And that's the mayor's job. You know, the police report exclusively to the chief, and the chief reports exclusively to the mayor, and you know, that's how it works."
So that's Jacob Fry in 2017, and then, as we see much later, you know, Jacob Fry is willing to blame everything, and his camp of people around him are willing to blame everything on the city council around policing and community police relations.
On the city council, on the community, on anything and everything other than themselves and the police.
Yeah, so it's one of the, like, the 2017 campaign and some of the stuff that he ran on is another big tell of, like, you know, this thing that I think we've already raised a little bit, which is like, What does Jacob Fry really believe? Is he a person of integrity? Is he an actor of integrity in public life? And like, obviously everybody in, you know, in elected office is being tugged in different ways. And like the job of a politician is not exactly to be honest, right? Like, let's, you know, be clear about what the profession is like normally. But I do think there's a clear and qualitative spectrum, you know, qualitative differences along a spectrum in terms of like, how does a politician, an elected politician actually act? Like, everybody is going to be swung in the wind by some degree, if, you know, but there are people who are willing to take losses, right? There are people who are willing to, like I say with Betsy Hodges, go into rooms and say the thing that isn't the most salient or pleasant thing to say in that room. Like, there are people who are more rooted in and accountable to like some grassroots, you know, movement or set of organizations of like regular, ordinary people. And Jacob Fry is somebody who seems very willing and eager to make big promises and then just completely like let that fall, dissolve into the ether and never even mention it again in ways that are just wild. I mean, right, like one of his other famous pledges from 2017 is, I will end homelessness in 5 years. That was a long time ago. We've talked about how far away we are from that outcome. And he just doesn't even... But the thing that really galls me is he doesn't even like try to tell a story of what happened. Like, he's not like, hey, I made this pledge and it wasn't possible and here's why and here's how we get back on track with it. Here's the things that we chose collectively not to do that we could have chosen to do and maybe we would be here by now. Like, there's no integrity to how he acts in public. And I just think, like, to me, that it drives me completely nuts. Because like, you know, we'll get to it later, right? Like, I've seen parts of my neighborhood burn down because of his lack of integrity. It's affected me personally on a number of issues that I've cared about and worked on. And also, it's just like, I think fundamentally erodes the potential for democratic agency. Like, we have such a problem in this country of people feeling like what we do matters around our public life. Like, feeling like there's any agency of regular people over what outcomes happen in Congress, in the state, in the city. Like, the lifeblood of democracy is a feeling, a belief by enough people that if we get together and think, you know, hard and try to collaborate, that we can achieve something that improves our lives. And if you don't believe in that, then democracy fails. And we're seeing democracy fail right now. So I get really incensed about even just this local piece of that puzzle, Jacob Fry, his career, the way he's acted, because I think it's that sort of mendacity, that lack of integrity contributes in powerful ways to that kind of outcome.
Yeah. It corrupts the whole process, the whole system.
That's really well put. It feels a little bit like he's some kind of a con artist. And I think politicians and narratives, and RT was really good at saying things as mayor and spinning things, way better than Betsy Hodges was probably. But also, he was more honest and he was more clear and he was more consistent with when he said it. And he also wouldn't overpromise like that. And it's almost like the Fry supporters don't care about what he says, that it doesn't line up with anything. And like, they know it's a spin and they know it's a picture and it's an image. And I've heard from people who've worked in City Hall that this mayor cares more about, and worked after I left, that I've talked to, care what he says, and it doesn't necessarily have to match at all what he does. And I think he'll still talk about doing something about homelessness now, and he still makes it a big issue, and he talks about all the affordable housing that he's helped get by giving developers money and having no ownership in them afterwards as a city. But, and he's done some other stable homes, stable schools he loves to rant about. So he knows those issues are important still, and he's saying different stuff now. But, right, he doesn't own it, and he overpromises. The whole no-knock warrant thing, you know, it's all about nuance, I guess, and he didn't have the details specifically.
Let's talk more about that later.
Okay.
One of the things about that 2017 race that I think is really important for folks to understand, I don't think that it was his plan to run in 2017. I think that he was hoping to serve two terms and then have a relatively easy run for mayor. I mean, he was running for mayor the entire time, from 2011, I think. But I don't think that it was his schedule to serve one term on the council and then try to grab the big brass ring. He was convinced to do that, I think, by Lisa Goodman and Barb Johnson, in part because they were really, really angry that one of Betsy Hodges' staffers, Philippe Cunningham, filed for office against Barb and ended up beating Barb. And it was almost a, you're gonna come for us, well, we're going to come for you.
And it was one of the all-time upsets, right? I mean,
yes,
for Philippe Cunningham, young person, newcomer to elected office, to knock off Barb Johnson, who, you know, probably felt a certain entitlement to power at that point. That's a big upset.
Absolutely. And it was a big deal to have someone who was associated with the mayor running against a city council member, and especially that kind of a city council member who had been in office and, you know, her family had owned that seat for four decades at that point. I think it was very much a enmity and pique kind of a decision. And Jacob kind of allowed himself to be used that way. The other thing that I think we really need to continue to remember is that the Star Tribune had decided that Jacob Fry was their guy way back. It almost became a running joke on the third floor of City Hall how many puff pieces there were in the Star Tribune about Jacob Fry when he was just a council member. They were just in love with him. They had these beautiful pictures of him and his beautiful hair, and there was very little that was written about him that was in any way negative. And meanwhile, the Strib's coverage of Betsy was always negatively slanted, and the other joke in City Hall was that they never used a picture of her where it didn't look like she was like rolling her eyes or something. I mean, they found the worst pictures in the world to use for Betsy. So that was kind of the coalition that allowed him to run as strongly as he did in 2017. And then the first blow up of anger about policing that happened with Jamar Clark, and then especially the second blow up with Justine Ruzcik Damon, I think really helped propel him. I think he was also helped a lot by the fact that Ray Dean ran from Betsy's left, and she was not able to effectively consolidate the left behind her because the left was pretty pissed off, and not just about the Jamar Clark situation, but also about her reticence and reluctance on things like 15 now. So she had burned some bridges that she then really needed, and it enabled him to be the person with the most first choice votes, and no one else was able to consolidate. I think actually Ray Dean came second, and enough of the Betsy voters actually went to Jacob because Ray Dean was, I think they felt, too far to the left. So that he even in his mayoral run, he was very much a creature of the like downtown insider power broker, Star Tribune, big money coalition.
And I'll also just note that even without Philippe running, I think there was a lot of interest on that side of the council and elsewhere to do something about Betsy. And so, I mean, that was probably a great excuse to really get motivated when that was happening. But I think a lot of things Betsy had done, and the body camera thing, which was really her whole thing. Most of those people didn't want that. Even the police chief at the time didn't want body cameras. I think that was even taken out as part of that Latte Levy too. They messed with that as well. But anyway, the whole police accountability stuff that she'd been trying to move forward on, they were even opposed to. But I think having Philippe run gave them a great motivation too. So I totally agree.
Yeah, and I think we can't really overstate how hard it was to make progress on real accountability for police. I mean, it still is incredibly hard, but it was even a lot harder before the uprising in 2020. I mean, it was just like pulling nails, even with a very active, very organized grassroots mobilization and persistent mobilization around public safety and what does that mean and let's create alternatives. Like, it was really hard to make progress. And I think I look back a little bit, and in some ways I think Betsy Hodges was like maybe a little before the political moment for what she maybe could have pulled off if she was mayor later. She didn't seem to manage to hold the center left coalition through that initial, you know, part of all of the challenges to the status quo, right? The status quo that enables privileged people like myself to feel protected by the police, and a lot of other people to feel the brunt and the negative externalities of what people are voting for when they say they want police. And that seemed to leave that opening, and clearly it was exploited. And I think another Jacob Frey line, like campaign line from that year, really sticks out as like how he did it, and also the ominous portending of things to come, which is his refrain that Minneapolis is in the news for all the wrong reasons.
I'm Jacob Frey. We all love what makes this city so special. It's why I'm disgusted Minneapolis is in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons. Police shootings, intolerance, and inequality. We need a mayor who will bridge the divide, grow this city, and empower people to get ahead with creative ideas and hard work, no matter who you are or where you live. I'm Jacob Frey. Let's build a better Minneapolis together.
Right, like this is a guy who's promising, hey, this has been really bad. I'm going to pilot this ship so that we won't be in the news. And 3 years later, we are international news, right? So it's like, as we try to segue from the campaign to his first term in mayor, it's hard to look back and remember some of these things and just how far away from the mark we've ended up as a city.
Yeah. The feeling that I had was sort of a, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times sensation, because for the first time ever, we were able to elect a progressive council president. It was another progressive, at least small wave election. We brought in Jeremiah Ellison. I think there were other progressive changes elsewhere. Steve Fletcher in Ward 3 was a big change. Jeremy Schrader in Ward 11 was a big change. And all kind of in a more activist, progressive direction. And so we had the best council that we ever worked with. I think it was the most productive, and it had a lot of people on that council who were really there to like do important work in the world. They weren't just there to like fill a seat. They were there to really change things. And we had a new mayor who was, I would say at first anyway, not completely opposed to all of that stuff, but where things got rocky pretty quickly between the mayor and the council. It is funny to remember. So Bender is elected council president as the first act of that council. And one of Fry's staffers noticed that Fry and Bender are both names from Futurama. So they put out this, you know, the human character Fry hugging the robot character Bender meme about how we're all going to get along. And I feel like that lasted for a little while. It didn't evaporate immediately, but it did really start to fray pretty quickly, especially around issues of public safety, not only but especially.
Yeah, it seemed like it wasn't ever perfect, and there was a thought that maybe it could be, but I think there was always this idea. In fact, one of the problems was, I think, that a lot of the council members who got elected more on the progressive side had publicly been opposed to Jacob for mayor. So, and I think Bender was one of them. I know I was one of them. That was a time I decided I would endorse. I usually didn't endorse for mayor prior to that because it seemed like let the voters decide, but I was worried enough about it that I thought I should weigh in.
Who did you endorse?
Everybody but Fry. Wasn't it came out running that time?
Oh yeah, good question. I think she was, and I think you endorsed her and Dean and Betsy.
Yeah. So I was basically please pick up. And so that made it a little bit challenging, I think, and there was already some tension about how to come together. I also felt like Jacob wasn't a kind of strong leader and wasn't even going to carry on some of the other practices in the past. We had a heck of a time trying to have a strategic planning meeting and develop a new vision and new goals for the city. It seemed to get stalled. It was done differently. Did we even have a big strategic planning meeting? So under Stephen Bosacker and he was a city coordinator and others, but especially him, I think, and when RT was mayor, there was a big early on and they'd pack it into a couple months. They'd survey council members, have one-on-one meetings, and we'd have strategic planning. We'd have a vision statement, strategic directions and values that we'd be working on. And if you could influence those, it was a great thing because then you could point back to them and say, but we all agreed on this is our vision. This will help us get there. Jacob seemed not to be interested in that. The really big picture stuff and all of that, wasn't important to him for some reason. We ultimately did mostly the council come up with a vision like after 2 years, didn't we?
No, I don't think we ever did.
No, we did. We kind of rewrote it. I remember Philippe and I did, and it was very much Cam Gordon's Ward 2 vision statement, and even with some of the Garwood words in it, it's still there. It's still the city's vision.
Hilarious.
He hasn't bothered to rewrite it, but they ignore it, though. Anyway, it was tough, and I could tell that it was going to be tough early on with him. And it seemed like there were fewer meetings with Bender and Fry than with other mayors, although Betsy did a good job of isolating herself as well.
There was one place where I think there was a sense that, like, there's something really big that we have to address by law and that we need to address in a much more aggressive way than we ever have in the past, and that's land use. We had to write a new land use plan, and we now have a council majority that is pretty strongly in favor of some very big reforms to the way that we do land use that have a lot of opposition in the single family home neighborhoods, especially of like Southwest and the Lakes District. But there are a lot of council members who are basically on the side of doing that, even some of whom, like Jeremy Schrader, represent areas down there and are willing to at least try to bring their constituents along. I think he basically got tossed out of office after one term mostly because of that, although the whole uprising and policing stuff didn't help him. But I think that a lot of people had turned on him already. But anyway, so there was this idea that, like, we could get something really big and really important done on land use. We could allow small apartment buildings, duplexes, triplexes in a lot more places and have a positive impact on housing costs, the cost of rent in the city. And, you know, we put one of the people who understood that stuff and was most supportive of it in the role of council president. And Jacob was at least not opposed to that stuff, and in a certain sense, I think actually very aligned with it, partly because he, you know, was also very friendly to developers and developers who gave him money. But also, I think even when he ran in 2013 for the city council, he kind of was like a yes in my backyard kind of a character. And so there was an idea that we could kind of get along on that, and we basically did, and passed the 2040 plan, which I still think is one of the best things that council did. And Jacob didn't really do very much to pass it, but he did try to take a lot of credit after it passed, especially in like the national media.
And he gets a lot of credit third party. I mean, even I think had this like somewhat rosy perception of him on housing and like, oh yeah, he was part of that, even though maybe not necessarily.
He didn't do the work, but he didn't block it the way that another mayor might have. Not Betsy, I don't think, but another mayor might have been harder to get on that stuff.
Definitely. I think that really helped. I mean, he was pretty pro-density and pro-growth, and that was kind of a thing that he ran on. I think one of his big things was Minneapolis Rising. And so I think he was able to go along with all of that and probably really relieved that he wasn't in the weeds having to debate over whether it's three or four plexes or whatever the debates that we were doing. And I think you're right. That was one of the major accomplishments. And in all fairness, that's got strategic goals and objectives. And I'm sure that was part of the work is building. Now we have this comprehensive plan that's really big. Previous comprehensive plans had hardly tweaked anything. Yeah. Of course, this one we also had.
Since the 60s.
Pardon me?
Since the 60s.
Since the 60s.
I mean, we were really passing over and over again every 10 years the 1960s era master plan for the city.
Yeah. And we had the Met Council saying population's going to grow. You got to prove you can do something about it. So that gave us some cover. But I will also say that the fact that he didn't do much work on it says a lot, because it was an enormous amount of work. And if you were a council member, it was an enormous amount of work to deal with the people in your ward, the differing views, where, you know, the ultimate density, you know, zoning changes are going to go, what impact it's going to have, how do we understand it. It was also a really big turning point in terms of seeing the racist past of the city and the impacts that it's had. I don't think we could have passed it without that mapping prejudice project that was going on, and the racial covenant awareness, and all these other things that were happening.
And Black Lives Matter, right? Like, it had raised, as a movement, the salience of racial justice substantially in the country.
100%.
Yeah, that did even, like, on a bigger picture. And I will say, with policing and Black Lives Matter, and we'd been uncovering the racial disparities in policing and the criminal justice system as well, and that really helped. But getting that mapping of how it happened in Minneapolis's development and its history and how they were segregated neighborhoods really, I think, helped. I don't know. It almost made it really harder for the protected groups
to
push back. Because it was more blatantly obvious that, oh, you're just supporting past racist decisions if you do that or whatever. And so it was harder. So that was all very interesting. And it was interesting that Jacob decided not to get in the middle of any of it almost.
Well, and I think that was, in a certain way, a strategic decision on his part, because his base that had elected him and his closest allies on the council, like Lisa Goodman and Lynae Palmisano, did not like that plan. I mean, Lynae voted against it, and she was always has been one of his lieutenants on the council, and Goodman really, really didn't like it. And she especially didn't like that frame that land use decisions have anything at all to do with race. So him staying out of it was, in a certain sense, like hiding from a fight with his own people and allowing more courageous folks like Jeremy Schrader to be the ones to go get yelled at by a bunch of white homeowners in South Minneapolis about the fact that we're going to allow maybe a duplex on your block. And Jacob is just nowhere in that conversation as a person who is responsible for it, is doing it, can be blamed for it. So he can quietly take the credit with the folks who like the thing, but he never made himself a pinata while folks were actually pissed off about it. He was saying, basically, go chew on Jeremy.
And Lisa Bender.
And Lisa Bender and Cam. You know, go talk to the people who are really pushing this stuff. That's not me. And I think that was a pretty common way that he dealt with things that were relatively politically spicy.
Yeah, and I think it really ended up being hard on Bender.
Yeah.
What was he like, just like interpersonally? Did it change at all from city council to as a city councilor to him being the mayor? What was it like, just like interacting with him and the people he chose as staff?
I definitely saw him a lot less and saw him in more formal settings. He was a little bit more sort of protected, especially as the term went on. There were some folks in his office who were, So Peter Ebnett was a pretty good friend of mine. And I respected him a lot, and we worked together on a lot of stuff, especially clean energy partnership stuff. So there were folks in the office who I thought had their hearts in the right place and were really trying to use that position of power to do something worthwhile. And who really, I mean, I think in Peter's case, grasped the gravity of the climate threat and really cared about it. But there were a lot of other folks in that office. It was a very, very political office, which is a kind of a silly thing to say, because of course it's, they're always political offices, but that's kind of not the way that Betsy ran her shop. She had people who were dedicated to like particular policy areas. So she had Peter Wagenius, who was just like obsessed with transportation stuff and transit projects. And that's a lot of where their focus was on particular policy things. And Jacob basically had a giant communications shop with a couple of policy people, and especially poor Peter Ebnett ended up being the person on like housing and climate and I think transportation, and you know, like his portfolio seemed to keep growing to include more and more issues. That I couldn't see how he could keep all of that stuff in the air at the same time. So just like a little anecdote, I served on the Bicycle Advisory Committee for a long time, and I went to all of those meetings and I really cared about it. And we basically formed that into a group that was really powerful and doing some very good work on everything that had to do with biking in Minneapolis, especially infrastructure projects. And when Betsy Hodges was mayor and when R.T. Ryback was mayor, Peter Wagenius came to that group. Not always, but when he did, he was there. He was paying attention. He was trying to move stuff. The person that Jacob appointed went to one meeting of that body, sat next to me, about halfway through, leaned over to me and said, "Do you really go to all of these?" In a way that was like, "What the hell is even happening here? What is this?" And never came back. And so we just didn't have a mayor's representative that whole 4 years. And I think that's kind of, you know, if like the zero waste plan is another great example of this. There was all kinds of work that had been done by previous administrations, Betsy's, but also RT's, that just was allowed to kind of fall on the floor because it wasn't in Jacob's wheelhouse, or it wasn't a thing he had decided he cared about. And I think I've mentioned this on a past podcast, there was a similarity between the way that he approached Betsy Hodges and the way that Donald Trump approached Barack Obama, which was basically like, whatever my predecessor did, I'm going to do the opposite of that. She had a policy shop and they weren't very good at communications, and I think that's true. I'm going to have a communications shop.
And by communications, you mean public communications. We're talking about PR messaging. Spin.
She cared a lot about transportation. I'm not really going to think about that. She cared about waste and recycling and composting. I'm not really going to care about that. And in some ways, that was a little bit freeing when we had a great council, because he's not in the way. We can just go run on those kinds of things. Not for office, but like we can just make a bunch of changes. But it also, you know, if there was staff intransigence, they had the cover of the mayor not paying attention to it, not caring about it, not understanding it.
Yeah, I mostly saw Jacob at formal things. There wasn't really many one-off meetings to discuss things. I think he sometimes would meet with council members before the budget one-on-one. At least I remember one or two of those, but not much. But we had an executive committee then. Executive committee would deal with labor disputes and also lawsuits. So we'd be together in a room discussing police misconduct cases. I think there were some pretty horrendous ones that were hard to sit through. Also, sometimes about appointments. He wasn't necessarily very involved in everything. Sometimes he would send somebody to deal with it. I remember I was chair of a housing committee, I believe, and we had to find a new director of the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and were involved in that. And he just sent and seemed to trust Abdi Salah, his aide, to handle that and handpick somebody and bring him in to be chair. Mohammed Issa, I believe, was the one that ended up, and I supported and met and interviewed, and but that was an appointment of the mayor's. And then also we had to hire the new executive director, Abdi Warsami, and that was a big rigmarole. And he was mostly hands off and just kind of letting his staff deal with that more.
When you say staff, I mean it was basically always like one of two people. It was when we were interfacing with folks about public policy stuff, it was Heidi Ritchie or it was Peter Ebnen. There's a whole comms
shop. Housing was
Abdi Salah. Yeah.
And maybe more housing was with him. I can't really remember, but you're right. It was just a few staff. The executive committee was would meet openly, and there'd be stuff to talk about there sometimes and some appointments. But there were youth coordinating board that he didn't always go to, which was another thing. And then there's the Clean Energy Partnership that we both served on, I think, that whole term. I actually got to the big table that term, didn't I? Yeah. And that was interesting. And he didn't seem to always necessarily be informed or not about some of those things. And he seemed to pick trusted staff and just basically go along with them for a lot of the issues.
And so this is, the Clean Energy Partnership is a great example of where his incapacity to understand or pay attention or care about an issue that wasn't one of his major issues or wasn't public facing really hurt progress. So we were working on something called inclusive financing, which is about trying to let folks put the cost of an energy upgrade for their home, even if they're renting their home, on their utility bill rather than having to take debt out themselves and pay for it up front. And Xcel had no interest in working on this with us. And we had like a little sliver of a chance with CenterPoint Energy. And we spent, gosh, 2-3 years attempting to get them to come with us to, I think it was the PUC, maybe, yeah, the Public Utilities Commission of the state of Minnesota, to allow a pilot for this. And it was really complex and hard. And his staff, Peter Ebnen, worked right in the trenches with Carly Weinman and me and others to try to get this thing moved forward. And there was one really crucial, pivotal meeting of the Clean Energy Partnership Board where we were going to make a big decision on inclusive financing, and we were trying to get CenterPoint to do what we wanted them to do. And we had a briefing. We always had a briefing for all of the principals. So it was you, Jeremy Schrader, Steve Fletcher, and Jacob Fry. And, you know, we all got together in the mayor's conference room right next to his office, and we went through the agenda line by line, and we had, you know, we talked about how important it was that we have a united front because the utilities are going to try to divide us if they possibly can, and we had a whole strategy for going into the meeting. And then so Jacob got to chair the meeting of the Clean Energy Partnership, and after the introductions, the first thing was about inclusive financing. And Jacob pointed down at the agenda, and he said, "There's this word that's capitalized here, and I wonder why it's capitalized. Why are we capitalizing if?" And I wasn't there, but I've heard about it both from you and from others. That it was like there was this uncomfortable silence from all sides, and then one of his staff, I think maybe one of the sustainability staff, said, "Mr. Mayor, that." Refers to inclusive financing, the thing that we're here to talk about. And it was just like he had flown an airplane through with a banner behind it that said, "I don't understand or care about this." And that was exactly what the utilities needed to say, "No, we're not going to do that." And they, of course, said it slowly and painfully over the next few months, you know, of reluctance to move their feet. But having the really clear indication that, like, the mayor doesn't get this enough and hasn't spent enough time with it to even know what the acronym is for the thing and why we would be using IF as a capital.
And it's weird. What a weird thing to chime in with in the midst of this meeting where your staff has been invested for a while and you're not there most of the time and you're parachuting in. Why would you even call that out?
Even if it hadn't been such a ridiculous cell phone on the policy, what a pedantic, strange, tiny thing to waste. I mean, we had vice presidents of major, investor-owned utilities at this table. Like, why are we going to talk about whether there's a typo in the agenda? Why does anybody need to hear about that? And it kind of shows one of his characteristics. He focuses in on really small stuff. And in part, that I think has served him well because that's where his truthiness can kind of reside. If he can make the technical argument that might be defensible, that it kind of covers the greater lie. But yeah, in that case, it's just like no one needed to hear any of that. Even so, it was all risk and no reward to bring that up.
It almost seemed like he was confused about what the agenda item was. So he wasn't even remembering that the first thing we're going to talk about or this, or didn't review it soon enough before the meeting or something. So the question just wasn't like, what's the typo there? But it was like, I don't understand what I'm supposed to say now because that's confusing to me. So I don't know. And everybody makes stupid mistakes. And that's pretty laughable. And I'm sure I've made some too. But it's probably indicative of what he's paying attention to and what's important to him too. So,
yeah, I mean,
it's a good funny story.
The mistakes that you would tend to make were like mispronouncing things. The mistakes that you would make.
We can do a separate episode on where the mistakes Cam used to make. That might be a good one. Yeah,
a lot of typos in those emails sometimes. But very very seldom was the mistake of a quality that was like, Cam does not care about this thing that he's talking about right now. And that's something that happened regularly with Jacob.
It's kind of sad because inclusive financing or pay on your bill or whatever you want to call it still hasn't become a reality. So yeah. I don't think he necessarily cared about it. And then when newcomers came and didn't know about it, it didn't really have legs either. But it would be really a good thing to keep working on, and it's working in other states.
And I think that same thing happened to a lot of different issues. I think we got slow walked on a lot of stuff. We got slow walked on development things in Prospect Park by staff. We got slow walked to a great degree on that ordinance to make it so that renters could purchase the buildings that they live in. And some of that, I think, was a quiet signal from Jacob and his allies, like, don't help with that, don't do that. But in some cases, I think it was actually just like neglect. There was no force that we could go to and say, hey, we could really use some help with this city department on this issue, and have a mayor who would intervene in a positive way on those things.
And I think that points to a bigger issue that a lot of politicians probably get involved with, and what you were even referring to about, if Betsy liked it, I'm not going to work on it. And I noticed that, and they were things that I liked. But there's sort of an impression I have of Jacob is either you're on the team, and for a while, I think in the early years, or I'll work to maybe get you on the team, or I'll try to make you like me anyway. But it definitely shifted. And if you're not on the team, you're not on the team, and I don't care about you. And that's not very important to me anymore. And that's, I think, modus operandi for him in a lot of ways. And rather than actually thinking about the value of zero waste and how really important it is and how that fits into wherever he wants to get the city to, he just thinks, oh, that's something Cam and Robin liked or Betsy liked. I don't care about that.
Or Lisa Bender.
Yeah. And so that a lot of things, I think, wasn't his priority. He's not going to own it, and he's not going to care about it. But I'm still not quite sure especially getting ready for this podcast, because I was thinking about Jacob and where he's gone. I think it's a mix of things, because I think it also points back to really who he is and what his values really are. And it's not just that I wasn't maybe on his team and didn't support him, and part of it was probably transactional and that kind of stuff, but he actually doesn't value a lot of those things.
Yeah.
I think he actually values, you know, more of a capitalistic free market approach and wealth or something. I mean, I don't know really how to get at it, but I, especially seeing how quickly he aligned in 2017 with that part of the council and stayed there. And even when we got to him supporting the 2040 planets, well, that's because it's probably aligned with a whole bunch of what he thinks is how what's good for the world. And what's good for the world is development, growth, and people making money and making decisions over other people. I don't know. So it's probably more complicated than either of the two simplistic notions that I'm going with, but there's definitely a mix there. And I think he does hold grudges.
Yeah, the team thing, I think, is really important. I think he did decide midway through his first term that there were going to be teams, there were going to be council members that he was just not going to work with anymore or actively oppose. One of the other things that I think became a defining characteristic of his time as mayor is that he formed a symbiotic relationship with his police chief, who was Rondo Arredondo. And he, you know, he came in after that 2017 election where there had been a longstanding protest for, I don't remember exactly how long the Jamarth Clark thing went for, but it was long, and it was almost kind of like a siege of that police precinct.
Yeah, it was an occupation, I think, is what we call it.
Yeah, occupation. And then the killing of Justine Damon Ruzczyk. So I think he had on his agenda, like, I have to do something about the police department. And Rondo offered him this wonderful opportunity because he had, I mean, you know, he sued the police department back in the 90s, 80s, 90s. When he was an officer, for discriminatory practices by the police department against him as a black officer. He had been seen as a real reformer from within MPD. And I think a lot of people, not just Jacob, I think a lot of council members, I think a lot of people in the community had this idea that, like, if we can just get a great chief like Arredondo, that is going to take care of the situation in terms of policing in Minneapolis. And I think Jacob went all in on that and had that, you know, he and Rondo were a team versus whoever else, versus the world, if that's what it came to. And Rondo started to do some stuff that was not great. When he asked for wildly more police officers than could possibly be budgeted for. I don't remember the number exactly, but it was
would have brought us up to like 1,300 police. He said we need another, I think it was 500 by 2024 or 25. We had almost 900 police at, you know, around that time, between 800 and 900 police. So it would have brought us up to like 1,300 police by now, which would be just an insane. I mean, it would be more than double the number of sworn officers we have actually operating right now at around 600, right?
And even at the time, it was like I need a billion. You know, it was such a radical number that on the council side of the third floor, it was like he wants a pony. What does he want? He wants this is not a serious request. A unicorn, yeah. Go find me a unicorn. And you know the whole. The thing dropped about the fact that they had been drugging people in coordination with HCMC and various ketamine. Various other much smaller scandals bubbled up, And in every one of those cases, Jacob's approach was to circle the wagons around Rondo and to stand next to Rondo and slightly behind Rondo while Rondo was at a lectern. Like maybe Jacob would start the question and answer, but then he would go stand behind Rondo, and it was very much like Rondo was his shield in terms of these issues. And it seems like he had basically decided, like, my chance at being a good and popular mayor is for Rondo to succeed, to get what he needs, and not be questioned by anybody, and continue to be popular, and let's just all cross our fingers and hope it goes really well.
Well, he even got reelected while Rondo was still there. But yeah, that's interesting. And I think that's another thing that the mayor does, is find somebody that he can put confidence in and let them do whatever they want. And I think Margaret Anderson Kelleher is an example of what he seems to be doing now. He's tried to pick other people, but I also think it really helped him to have a mayor, a person of color, who seemed like was going to be a really good racial justice kind of advocate. And then it was difficult. So I was supportive of Rondo. Actually, Rondo was in the 4th precinct when I was outside and they were rioting, and I was able to call him on the cell phone. They weren't really rioting, hanging out and protesting. We saw police in riot gear coming over the hill, and I called Rondo and I said, I forget what I said. I basically said, you need to call them back. This crowd is going to lose control of itself, and we're going to lose control of everything. And he did call him back. So it seemed like he was somebody who'd be accessible and I could work with. And he did try to meet with council members even after he was chief. But it seemed like the police culture got to him so much, and the fear of losing control of the rank and file made him change dramatically, and maybe pressure from the mayor too, but it was very sad to watch.
And then the whole thing exploded when Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd.
And that's where we're going to leave things for today. So tune in, look forward next week to part 2 as we tell the story of Jacob Fry right here on Mill City Hall.